Well, good morning, Grace family. Great to be with you guys finally. This, as Pastor Matt said, this is actually day 7 of my first sabbatical in 28 years. So if I seem extra happy, you'll understand why. Like this is getting fun. We tried to make this happen for a while, and we just couldn't make schedules work. And so finally, the sabbatical was carved out, and I just couldn't resist making Austin my first stop of the journey. And really great to be here with you all. It's a great, great city. We'd really never spent any time here before. My wife, Norma Jean, and I have been here for, this is our fourth day in town, and it's beautiful. Love the people, we've loved the weather. It's been nasty up north, weather-wise. We visited the Capitol building yesterday, and we did breakfast at the Driscoll Hotel 2 days ago, and I tried to see bats last night. The bats were shy, they never came out, so that was kind of a waste of time. But other than that, it's been great to be here in Austin. We would love to live in the South. We feel like we'd probably stay here forever if it weren't for the fact that God has made his calling really clear to minister in our home state of New Jersey. So I would say people of New Jersey are a little different than people in other parts of the country. Maybe I would characterize it as a little more blunt and direct. Just a recent example of that, after Christmas, I decided to grow out my beard, so I had a pretty full beard up until about 10 days ago. One of the reasons that I shaved was I walked into church 2 Sundays ago, and a lovely woman, middle-aged woman that I know fairly well, looked at me, and she said, "Pastor Dave, you are looking more and more like my dog." So she said that to her pastor. So I think people in Texas might think that, and the people in Jersey just say it. You know, they just say what's on their mind. So we love our culture. We love our church is truly a family. And, you know, I've traveled enough to know that people are people wherever you go. People desperately need love. And the love of Christ is the one love that meets that need. And that's what keeps me going in ministry. That's what keeps me going in just walking with God, that the love of Christ has become so precious to me the older I've gotten. And it's just a beautiful, life-giving thing. So it's a joy for me to be in ministry. So as Pastor Matt said, Norma Jean and I are married 35 years next month, and I'm so grateful for this woman. She's my best friend. She's my partner in everything that I do. We're so proud of our 4 adult kids. Our life verse is Matthew 10:8. That's where Jesus said to his disciples, "Freely you have received, freely give." So to us, our life has become all about recognizing all that God has freely given us, spiritually, materially, financially, experientially, and then turning around and just pouring that out freely to other people. In fact, when I just heard the story about your church blessing this other church in Liberty Hill, that's exactly what I'm talking about, a life that finds joy in just pouring out for others. So that's a vision that really inspires us. So I want to thank Pastor Matt for opening up the pulpit to me. I know that's a big deal. I know it requires a lot of trust, so I appreciate the privilege of being here. So I want to talk today about the famous story of Joseph. Epic story, takes up the 14 final chapters of the book of Genesis. But as I look at Joseph's story, there's a theme that emerges very clearly to me, and it's this. All throughout Joseph's life, he was mistreated over and over again. And so if you really want to understand Joseph, you have to look closely at his mistreatment and how he responded to that mistreatment. You know why that matters so much? Because in this life, you and I will be mistreated. You already knew that. In this broken, fallen world, you and I will be mistreated. Maybe not in the same ways that Joseph was. Maybe not in the same ways as the person sitting next to you this morning. But we will be insulted and excluded and disrespected and stabbed in the back and kicked in the gut and maligned and left out, and I'm sure you already have. And so this morning, as we walk through the life of Joseph and as we reflect on our own lives, I'm going to actually use a physical thing to represent the mistreatment that we receive. So this backpack represents your life. And these rocks represent the different ways that you get mistreated in life. So I don't know how well you can see them, but some of the rocks are smaller, like when you get cut off by another driver on 183. Some of the rocks are bigger, like when your spouse or your boyfriend or girlfriend cheats on you. But every time we get mistreated, another rock gets placed into our bag. Joseph had a lot of rocks in his bag. Some of you have a lot of rocks in your bag, and we've all got some, and they're real, and they're heavy, and they're painful. But this is what you have to see. The person that you become in life is influenced hugely, maybe more than anything else, by how you respond to those rocks. So I'm going to divide today's message into two parts. The first part is called Mistreatment Received. Mistreatment Received. When you look at Joseph's story, there are three main episodes of mistreatment that he experiences. First one, I'm going to call abuse. Let's just set the scene. Joseph was the second to youngest son of Jacob, out of his 12 sons. And early in the story, we get a window into Joseph's relationship with his father. Look with me at Genesis 37, verse 3. Now, Israel, which was another name for Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. You already see the family dysfunction, right? Favoritism, sibling rivalry. This is not good. Look what happens next. Verse 5. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out of the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Right after that, he has another dream where the sun and the moon and 11 stars, remember how many brothers he had? We're all bowing down to him. And his whole family's just saying, "You gotta be kidding me." Eventually, all of that bad blood comes to a boil. The older brothers are out tending their flocks, and dad sends 17-year-old Joseph to go out and check on his brothers. The brothers see him coming, and they formulate a plan. Pick up the story in verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." He's a really nice guy. His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. And this is an old pencil drawing of that moment when he was pulled up out of the cistern and sold to slave traders by his brothers. So Joseph was physically overpowered. He was violently stripped of his clothing. He was forced into a hole in the ground, and he was sold like a piece of property. I would say that qualifies as abuse, wouldn't you? I know that in telling this part of the story, there are some of you for whom this is all too personal because you have experienced abuse. And I tread so lightly here because I know that abuse is so personally devastating and so life-affecting, but for some of you, that's been your story. You had maybe a father who couldn't control his temper, and he let it out on you physically, or maybe you had a mother who was unhappy, and she let it out on you verbally, or maybe the other way around. Maybe you've had a boyfriend or a husband who lashed out at you with belittling insults, or with physical beating, or with sexual abuse. Abuse it's confusing. It's terrifying, it's dehumanizing, and every time we experience it, there's a really heavy rock that gets put in our bag. In fact, I'm going to choose the biggest one for this. And I need to say this to any of you here who have experienced abuse. I am so sorry. And if you are experiencing abuse now in any way, it's not all right, and you should please reach out for help, and you should get yourself to safety if at all possible. And I also want to say this. If you have been abused by anyone and you feel like the person who did it got away with it, you need to hear this. They didn't get away with it, because they will stand before God and face Him someday. The rocks of abuse are some of the heaviest that we will ever have to carry in our lives. And so as Joseph was being carried off by the Ishmaelite traders, he was feeling the weight of that rock in his bag. Second kind of mistreatment is accusation. Accusation. Story takes an interesting turn here. Look with me at Genesis 39, verse 1. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. That's a nice break, right? Instead of getting assigned to dig ditches or make bricks or something, Joseph winds up in the home of this Egyptian government official named Potiphar, quickly wins the respect of his master. He's given a position of high trust and high responsibility in the household. Potiphar realizes there's something about this kid. And the writer of Genesis tells us what that something is. The Lord was with him. Actually says that twice, just to make sure we don't miss it. And as you read the story and you see how Joseph acts and the things that he says, you can tell Joseph knows it too. He knows that God is with him. Even with everything he's been traumatized with and all that's been stripped away, he recognizes God has not left him. And then the story takes another turn. Pick it up midway through Genesis 39:6. Now, Joseph was well-built and handsome, and after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." This was a woman who was probably used to getting what she wanted, the wife of a powerful Egyptian government official. And the way that she propositions Joseph makes it very clear that she's in charge and he's the slave. In our English version, it says, "Come to bed with me." In some English versions, it says, "Lie with me." In the Hebrew, it's actually just two words, and it's a very blunt command. Tim Keller suggests that you could translate it, "Sex now." This is a woman who expected to get what she wanted. Verse 8, "But he refused." Verse 10, "And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, 'Come to bed with me.' But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house." This is a painting by a painter named Luis Matoy around 1630, depicting the moment when Joseph left his cloak in her hand and fled. Verse 16, "She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. 'That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house.' When his master heard this story that his wife told him, saying, 'This is how your slave treated me,' he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined." So for doing the right thing, for refusing to get involved with this married woman, Joseph finds himself once again in the pit. And another rock had been added to his bag. And this time it's the rock of accusation. More specifically, false accusation. Anybody have any of those rocks in your bag? Somebody has accused you of something that's not true. Maybe someone at work, maybe a grown child accusing you as their parents of something that's just not true, maybe your spouse or your ex-spouse. And it's not reality, but the person insists on it. They're probably talking to other people about it. And that false accusation possibly has tarnished your reputation, or maybe it's just making you feel depressed, like there's nothing you can do about it. You feel like you're sitting there in a pit because your reputation has been damaged. As if that's not enough, Joseph experiences one more kind of mistreatment. I'll call it abandonment. So once again, while he's in prison, things take an encouraging turn. Look at Genesis 39, halfway through verse 20. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. There it is again. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. So once again, Joseph rises to the top because God is with him. And then he gets his big break. In that same prison, he meets two guys, the chief cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt. They've offended the king somehow, and so they've gotten themselves thrown into prison. Joseph is put in charge of them. One night, both of those two guys have very vivid dreams, and the next morning they say, "We've had these weird dreams, and we can't figure them out." And Joseph says, "All interpretations belong to God. Tell me your dreams." So they tell Joseph what they dreamed. And for the baker, it's bad news, because his dream means that in 3 days, he'll be lifted up out of the prison and have his head taken off. For the cupbearer, his dream is good news, because his dream means that in 3 days, he'll be taken out of the prison and restored to his former role. And Joseph says to the cupbearer, "Listen, when that happens, when you get out of here, put in a good word for me. I don't deserve to be here. Help me get out of here." So sure enough, 3 days later is Pharaoh's birthday. He has these birthday festivities, and as part of the festivities, he releases these two well-known prisoners out of prison, and sure enough, the baker gets his head taken off, the cupbearer gets his old job back, and Genesis 40 ends with these depressing words. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. Oof. You know what it feels like to be forgotten? To be abandoned? It's a traumatic thing to experience. Maybe you were abandoned by your father before you were even born. Or maybe you were abandoned by your father after you were born, and that was even more painful. I'm sure some of you have been abandoned by your spouse. You've heard those devastating words, "I don't want to be married to you anymore," because maybe they found somebody else, or maybe they're just done with you. Having raised 4 kids and having been a kid myself, I know how common it is in middle school and high school to feel abandoned by your friends, just left out, overlooked. Some of you know that the feeling to walk into a classroom or a cafeteria and just feel invisible, like literally nobody cares or knows that you're even there. And whenever you feel abandoned like that, there's another rock that gets put into your bag. Pray for my back tomorrow. You know, it's almost hard to believe that one person could experience that much mistreatment. If you think about Joseph's life, right? He had this brief period of childhood where he was dad's favorite and everything was great, but then he had been brutally abused, he had been falsely accused, he had been utterly abandoned. Rock after rock had been put into his bag. And so as he sat there in prison year after year, it's hard to imagine how one person could carry that kind of weight. I have a good friend at home who went through a series of a few years where he had just loss after loss. One of their kids took his own life. One of their other kids was in a car accident where the driver of the other car was killed, had financial problems and marital problems. And I remember sitting across from him at coffee one day and him just saying, "I don't know how much more I can take. I don't know if I can go on living if it keeps being like this." And I understood what he was saying. Maybe that's how you're feeling. Maybe your bag is just really heavy. You know, over the years, I've noticed that when we're feeling that there's been so much put in our bag, it tends to affect us in certain ways. And one of those ways is we very often feel sorry for ourselves. Sometimes we like to complain about what's in our bag, right? "Have I told you about this? Have I ever told you about how this person did to me? Did you see this rock?" Sometimes we compare our bag of rocks with other people, right? Like, "Oh, that's not a bag of rocks. I'll show you a bag of rocks." And then here's where it gets really ugly. We start to dream about revenge. We realize that this bag of rocks actually makes a pretty good weapon. And so you dream about ways that you can get back at some of the people who've done you wrong. how you can make them feel a little bit of the pain that they've caused to you. And you realize this bag of rocks is a good way to keep people at a distance. How dare you challenge me? How dare you disrespect me? You have no idea what's happened to me. And so we define ourselves by the rocks in our bag. We define ourselves as victims because we have been sinned against. And in that sense, we're just like Joseph. And yet, Joseph had a secret. Joseph knew something about life. He knew something about reality, about God, that radically affected the way he responded to the rocks in his bag. And that leads us right to our second and final point. Let's talk about mistreatment redeemed. So after he'd been forgotten by the cupbearer, Joseph sits in that prison for, you ready? 2 more years. And then something happens. Pharaoh himself has a dream, and it disturbs him. He calls for all his wise men. No one can interpret his dream. The cupbearer, remember that guy? Hears about it, and he goes to Pharaoh, and he says, wait, I totally forgot. That time you threw me into prison, remember? I had a weird dream. And there was this young Hebrew guy there, and he interpreted for me, and it turned out exactly like he said. And Pharaoh says, get me this guy. So Joseph comes to him, and he says to Joseph, well, I heard you're the dream guy. And I love Joseph's response. He says, not me, but God will give Pharaoh the answer that he needs. So Pharaoh tells him the dream. He says, I was standing on the bank of the Nile River in my dream, and then out from the river came 7 fat cows. And then all of a sudden, these 7 skinny cows came up, and they swallowed up the fat cows. And Joseph says, here's what it means. You're about to experience 7 years of abundance. That's the fat cows. But following those 7 years, there are going to be 7 years of scarcity and famine. That's the skinny cows. And so Joseph says, here's my advice. Find a wise leader. Put him in charge of gathering up extra grain during those 7 good years, so when the 7 years of famine comes, you'll have plenty to eat for everyone in your nation. And Pharaoh is so impressed with the spot-on interpretation and with the counsel that Pharaoh says, you got a job. And so Joseph is made the 2nd most powerful person in the entire kingdom of Egypt. You talk about a life of ups and downs, right? Sure enough, the next 7 years are abundant, and Joseph works the plan. He aggressively taxes everyone, a big portion of their grain. He stores it up. After those 7 years are completed, just like he predicted, all of a sudden the skies dry up, the ground becomes hard, crop production goes down to almost nothing, and word gets out that the only nation anywhere around that has anything to eat is Egypt. So here come these lines of people with their hands out coming to Egypt for food. And including in those people coming with their hands out are, guess who? Joseph's brothers, those rats. They come and appear before Joseph. And this scene is high drama. This is one of the reasons the Bible is such amazing and enduring literature. Because they don't recognize Joseph. I mean, he's all decked out in his Egyptian outfit, right? I mean, he's talking like an Egyptian. He walks like an Egyptian. I couldn't resist saying that. He is the last person that his brothers expect to see. And for all, they think he's dead or a slave somewhere. So they don't recognize him, but Joseph recognizes them. And after a while, he can't take the suspense anymore. Genesis 45:1, then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants. And he cried out, have everyone leave my presence. So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Can you even imagine this? I don't know how many hundreds of times I've read this passage. Every time I read verse 3, the hair on the back of my neck sticks up. Like it's doing it right now. I can't imagine this moment. So why were his brothers so afraid at that moment? Well, because they never forgot what they had done to him. And they were pretty sure he didn't forget either. Keep reading in verse 4. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. And brothers are probably thinking, no, we're good right here. But when they had done so, he said, I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And that's followed by this amazing scene of reconciliation and weeping and embracing. And if that doesn't melt your heart, I'm not sure you have a heart. So the brothers go back then, and they get their father Jacob, and there's another incredible reconciliation between, excuse me, getting all choked up. There's another incredible reconciliation between Joseph and his father, who can't believe that his son is still alive. And so the whole family then comes, excuse me, to live in Egypt. Seventeen years go by, and old Jacob dies. And the brothers of Joseph think, now that Dad's out of the picture, now he's going to take his revenge. Joseph finds out what they're thinking, and he speaks these beautiful words, Genesis 50, verses 19 and 20. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." You know, that first part of verse 20 is one of the most powerful truths in all of Scripture. The Hebrew literally says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." What do you do with all the rocks in your bag, with all the ways that you have been mistreated? Because those are real wrongs. You can't pretend that they didn't happen. They're part of your story. They're part of reality. But there's this other reality that Joseph knew. He knew that God was sovereign. What does that mean? It means that God's in control. And Joseph had an incredibly mature and, I would say, sophisticated and high view of the sovereignty of God. He actually says to his brothers, "It wasn't really ultimately you who sent me here, it was God." But now, wait a minute. Does that mean he's saying the brothers aren't really responsible or aren't really culpable for what they had done to him? He's not saying that at all. In fact, one of the first things Joseph says to them is, "I'm your brother Joseph. Remember the one that you sold into Egypt." So Joseph wasn't rewriting history. He knew they did it. He knew that it was evil. Not only that, but he knew that their intentions were wrong. Genesis 50, 20, "You intended to harm me." So their motives were wrong, their actions were wrong, they were completely wrong. Joseph was not letting them off the hook for what they did at all. And yet, he knew this God who was sovereign over even things like that and uses them in his plans. Listen, God is not the author of evil, ever. But God is brilliant and powerful and sovereign enough to steer even evil things and brilliantly work those into his plan. The New Testament echoes this truth. The most famous place, I would say, is Romans 8:28. And so I'm going to put the verse up on the board, and I want to just, let's just read this together out loud. You ready? "And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose." In all things, God works for good. Even in the things that were wrong and meant for wrong, even in the most painful rocks in your bag, God has this brilliant ability to redeem it and turn it and use it for good. So Joseph says, "Look, God took your evil act. That's how he got me to Egypt. And if I'd never come to Egypt, I never would have been thrown into Potiphar's prison. And if I was never thrown into Potiphar's prison, I would never have heard Pharaoh's dream. And if I had never heard Pharaoh's dream, nobody would have known that there was a famine coming. And if nobody knew there was a famine coming, countless people would have died, and basically the Jewish nation would have been wiped out." And so all through the mistreatment and the chaos and the pain, God had worked all things for good. Let me add one more thing. Because the nation of Israel survived, the line of the Messiah was preserved. And the more you look at the story of Joseph, the more you realize that it is pointing us inescapably to the story of Jesus. Think about it. Joseph was rejected by his own family. So was Jesus. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. John 1:11. Joseph was sold for a handful of silver. So was Jesus. Joseph was forcibly stripped of his clothing and left to die. So was Jesus. Jesus is, the story of Joseph is ultimately really the story about Jesus. And think about this, what Joseph's brothers did to him, they meant for evil, but God meant it for good, right? And what the Roman authorities and the religious leaders of the first century did to Jesus, they meant for evil, but God meant it for good. Because God raised up Joseph out of the pit and through him brought rescue to countless people. God raised Jesus from the dead and through him brought salvation to the world. Do you see it? That Jesus is really the ultimate Joseph. He's the greater Joseph. And when we are following Jesus, listen, our little world of self-pity and victim mentality and anger starts to change because we realize that, yes, our mistreatment is reality, but there's a deeper reality that we have a God who turns all things to good. And so if you are wrestling with this in your mind, I have to ask you a very important question, and it's this. Which of those two realities will you dwell on more? The mistreatment you've received or the sovereignty of our good God? Which one of those two realities will you allow to define you? If you're feeling the weight of the rocks in your bag, and if it's just such a part of you that not a day goes by that you don't think about it, that you don't dwell on it, that it doesn't bother you. If you feel that weight, the best thing I can tell you is to take it to the cross. Take it to the cross. Because when you do that, it won't change your history. That's part of what's happened in your life. But it will help you to see certain things a lot more clearly. When you get close to the cross, you realize we have a God who came to suffer with his people. Who else can say that about their God? He gets it. When you spend time around the cross, you realize we have a God who came not just to suffer with us, but just he wanted to be with us. Like it says about Joseph, the Lord was with him wherever he was. And Jesus stood in front of his disciples after the resurrection, and he said, "Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. He will never abandon us." And when you spend time around the cross, you realize that God took the biggest mistreatment, the worst mistreatment in all of history, right? The murder of the only perfect man, and he turned it into resurrection and life. That's what our God does. And so as you spend time around the cross, and as you allow your heart and your mind to be shaped by the cross, you will finally be able to do this. And you will be able to say, "I am no longer going to be defined by that, because I will be defined by this." And you will be free. I would love to pray for you as we close. I'm going to ask you to rise to your feet as we pray together. Let's look to the Lord. Father, I pray right now for my friends here who, as they've heard the story of Joseph, it's stirred up memories of some of their own mistreatment and some of the wounds that they carry. God, it's a tender moment for them, so I pray that you would lead them well, Lord. Give them what they need. And Father, I pray that you'd give us the grace to lift our eyes to Jesus, who was mistreated more than anyone in history. And Lord, help us to find our story in his story. Ultimately, Lord, I pray that we will not be weighed down by those backpacks, but that we will have the freedom, that we'd feel it from you, to take it off, to throw it at the foot of the cross. And Lord, I pray that we will walk free of that weight and that you would use us to help others to take those weights off so they may walk freely also. We love you, Lord. We pray for your grace. Help us to leave this place and represent Jesus really well. In his name we pray. Amen.